Okay, before we do start officially, I'd like to do the disclosures. So Dr. Storkel has no financial disclosures. I, however, do receive an honorarium for the SpeechLink, and I'm a presenter for SpeechTherapyPD.com, and I do receive royalty payments, and I own Speech Dynamics, my company. As far as non-financial disclosures, Dr. Storkel is a member of the USA Committee on Raising Awareness of Developmental Language Disorder, which helped actually to develop the content for this course. Very impressive. And I have no financial disclosures to report. So there we go. So once again, I'd like to welcome everybody to our live SpeechLink podcast, sponsored, of course, by SpeechTherapyPD.com. I am Char Beauchart, your speech-language pathologist host, and I'm so glad that you're here for our very practical topic, how and why to use the term DLD to raise awareness and generate connections. And before we begin, I would like to remind you that you, all of you, are more than welcome to participate during the podcast. Just type in your question or comment into the chat, and when appropriate, we'll read it and Dr. Storkel will respond. All right, Holly, let's jump in. Let me just share with you about this wonderful, very knowledgeable person. Dr. Holly Storkel received her BA in Speech and Hearing Sciences from Indiana University and her MS in Speech Language Pathology and PhD in Speech and Hearing Sciences from the University of Washington in Seattle. And she recently completed an online certificate in Implementation Science at the University of California, San Francisco. And Dr. Storkel began her career at the University of Kansas in 2001 as an assistant professor, then an associate professor, then a full professor. And while on the faculty, her research focused on helping children learn words and sounds so they could succeed in school and life. That's a good thing to do. And she conducted theoretical research to understand the nature of sound and word learning difficulties in preschool and early language, early school age children, as well as clinical research to develop and implement effective treatments for sound and word learning difficulties. She also held various administrative positions while at the University of Kansas, including department chair, associate dean, and vice provost. Whoa. So Dr. Storkel just recently, as in August 2022, joined the National Institute on Deafness and Other Communication Disorders as the Program Officer for Language. As a program officer, she administers grant funding programs, sets priorities for funding, and is an advocate for research on language and language disorders across the lifespan. Oh. Dr. Storkel is also a member of the USA Committee on Raising Awareness of Developmental Language Disorder, RADLD, is an international group advocating for greater public awareness of DLD. And the content of this course was developed in conjunction with USA RA.
So you can say rattled. R-A-D-L-D. We actually pronounce it rattled.
You do? Rattle?
Yeah.
Oh, a sandwich. Okay. All right. In conjunction with USA Rattle. I love it. And this is her second appearance here on the SpeechLink, and she does prefer to be called Holly. So welcome back to the SpeechLink, Holly.
Thanks, Char. I'm glad we managed to make it happen tonight. It was a little touch and go there. But
a little touch and go. Yes, it was. And thanks for hanging in there.
No problem. My pleasure.
Yeah, you never know.
Looking forward to talking to y'all. So happy to wait just a little bit.
Well, you're worth waiting for. I mean, and truly you are. I mean, I probably wouldn't say that if we didn't have our first podcast, which was really interesting. But you're an amazingly knowledgeable person. So I am very excited about this topic for a number of reasons. I was, formerly an SLP in the schools, and I'm very supportive and very grateful for this topic. You are talking with us about the term developmental language disorder, DLD, as being the designated term or the best term or the single term to describe students with language disorders, which encompass a whole variety of populations, as well as, I'm going to say, professionals who work with those populations. So this is actually huge. We're not just talking about language therapy as SLPs know it. this goes beyond. So get us started. Tell us about it.
Sure. So first, what I mean by developmental language disorder, who are we talking about? So we're talking about people who exhibit their language difficulties in childhood, although they might still persist into adulthood. So we might find adults who have this diagnosis as well. And those language difficulties are characterized by significant difficulty learning, understanding, and/or using spoken language. And these difficulties are not explained by other conditions or extenuating circumstances. So we're not talking about, for example, children with autism who also have language difficulties as part of that condition, or children with developmental delays who also might have language difficulties as part of that broader condition. We're talking about children who have primary language difficulties that aren't associated or don't have a diagnosis of a condition that we normally associate with language difficulty. So really, this is their primary diagnosis, their primary issue, although they might have other kind of comorbid difficulties. So they might also have things like ADHD that have some relationship with language, but there's not maybe a clear profile of language difficulties that are common across everyone with that diagnosis. So probably people are saying, I know that, but that's not what I call it. And that's the issue that really came up, that we've known about this group of children for a very long time, decades, but we've called it all sorts of different things. We've called it specific language impairment. We've called it suspected language impairment or suspected language delay or receptive or expressive language impairment or developmental dysphagia. I mean, we have all these different terms. And so kind of how this came about of a concern about all the terminology, I mean, I think many people have complained about that. So, you know, as an SLP, if you're wanting to find out, you know, how best practice for assessment or treatment of this group, and you're trying to search the literature, well, there's a million different terms. So you have to kind of search for all those different terms to try to make sure that you've, you know, found whatever's out there. Same kind of thing for researchers as well. So we've kind of known about this problem, but Dorothy Bishop, who's a researcher in the UK, is someone who really started to bang the drum about this. She did what she called the taxi driver test. And so as she was traveling around for her work and everything, she'd take cabs all over the place, and she'd ask people for her preferred term at the time, which was specific language impairment. So she'd ask them, have you heard about this? And I don't think she ever managed to find a single taxi driver who had heard about specific language impairment, but they did know dyslexia. They did know autism. They did know ADHD. And she started wondering, like, why is it that they know all of these other conditions, many of which are as common as DLD? So for example, dyslexia is as common as DLD. And the impact is similar as well. Folks with dyslexia have significant challenges, as do children with DLD. And so she started wondering, like, why do people not know about this? And she had a variety of ideas, but one of the things she wondered is it because we use so many different terms? Even amongst ourselves, we can't really agree on what this is. And so then we're also not providing information in an easy to find type of way. So she started to think that, you know, maybe we really needed to come to some consensus about what we're going to call this. And so what she did was she gathered a very broad group of folks. So it was an international panel. It included researchers, it included clinicians, it included parents or individuals who have DLD. And they went through kind of a rigorous process of deciding on what the term should be. So there was some discussion of, like, well, what are the key features? What do we need to highlight in the term? What are the best words to say that? How do we communicate that? And so they came up with developmental language disorder, DLD. And the reasoning behind it was that the developmental was important because it conveyed that it was something that we will typically observe in childhood. It's something that is early. It's not something that you get from a brain injury later in life or some sort of neurologic disease. So they thought that was really foundational to understanding what this is. Language, for the obvious reason that it's difficulties with expressive and or receptive language. And then disorder to indicate that it was really a lifelong condition. This is not something children grow out of, although their strengths and weaknesses may change over time, and we certainly can help them through our intervention efforts. But it's not going to go away, and they're not suddenly going to be facile with language and have no struggles around that. And so that was thought to be another important component that folks needed to recognize, that this would be lifelong, that we would see adults who would still be having some of the effects or maybe some challenges from their language difficulties. So this was the term that she really suggested, or that the community agreed on through this consensus process, that we should use this term, use it consistently, and start building this public awareness of what this condition is, so that that would hopefully, you know, start to open doors for funding. Wouldn't that be great? Funding and more speech language pathologists in schools, and, you know, greater access to services for individuals who have this condition.
Well, you're on the cutting edge there, girl, aren't you, in your new position?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you're kind of in charge of funding and what gets funded and research and topics and so on. I mean, you know, you're perfect for that position, I would think. So, yeah, and I imagine you're going to really enjoy doing that too.
And as I mentioned, NIDCD, the National Institute of Deafness and Communication Disorders, that's the group that I'm working for now. Mm-hmm. They do have a long history of funding research in this area, and regardless of what we choose to call it. But again, they were aware for decades that this group of individuals was out there, and that is part of their mission area, to help us understand the types of challenges that these children face, and to learn different ways where we can better identify these children earlier, as soon as possible, and in different sorts of contexts. So bilingual children, children who speak multiple dialects, where sometimes those assessment issues start getting, you know, really complex and convoluted, in addition to the treatment research. NIDCD also has kind of a public awareness role as well, because we have a website, and there are some fact sheets and things that are aimed at the public. So we're also revising what had been our specific language impairment fact sheet to now use this term, developmental language disorder, and to update it with some of the information that's coming out about what parents and the public need to know about this. So that's another thing that we're taking on at NIDCD to help build awareness and contribute to this advocacy campaign.
Great, great. Well, you're talking about parents, that's wonderful, and the public as a whole. What about teachers and school psychologists and resource specialists and other personnel that work in the school? I mean, that, because, you know, we sort of get pigeonholed, oh, he's a language kid. And I remember school psychologists saying, well, you did all the language testing, let's hear from you, you know, and pointing to me, like they weren't in, you know, they were not doing a language assessment of sorts themselves. So there's kind of that separation that SLPs sort of own that at this point, but not really. I mean, language is the method of instruction.
Yes. Yes. And that is definitely another important group of, and I would say even in medical settings as well, other folks there that might be
definitely
involved in care of a child. And so mm-hmm. really, you know, we don't want to kind of put that SLP in a silo with these kids. We really need the whole team to understand who these kids are and what their challenges are. And so I think probably our SLPs also are very familiar with, you know, teachers who don't really understand kids who have developmental language disorders. I can remember when I was practicing, working with a high school student who was very smart, very bright, also very socially outgoing, but had lots of really serious and significant language challenges. And, you know, the teachers were really kind of perplexed by him. I mean, their explanation was that he was lazy and that he was goofing off with his friends. But the truth of the matter was he was really having a hard time keeping up with what was going on in class and understanding what was happening and the amount of effort it took him to do his assignments and things like that, you know, were very draining. And, you know, the teachers just couldn't kind of reconcile that of like, he's so bright, he's so outgoing, and yet he doesn't do these things. Why doesn't he do these things? You know, so we have a hard time really thinking about what language is. If you're not an SLP who has gone through that master's program and that undergraduate education to understand speech and language and hearing and cognition and how all of these systems also interact, you know, language is really hidden. And so when kids are doing behaviors, we tend to kind of interpret the most kind of simplistic explanation for it. You know, they're misbehaving. Well, they're just bad. They're just ornery. When maybe they didn't understand the instruction, like that's not necessarily the first thing you go for. Or a kid who's hitting another kid because they can't do that verbal negotiation to get the thing that they want. And again, you just say, oh, they're just poor behaved and they don't have any patience and da 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 da. And you're not thinking through to that language. So, you know, having this term and really sharing that broadly with team members, you know, gives us an opportunity to educate about what language is, what that looks like. I'm sure all the SLPs in the schools can also relate to being called the speech teacher. And we don't just do speech. So, you know, kind of highlighting that language piece in this name, I think is really helpful. And then being able to explain, you know, what do we mean by language? What kinds of challenges do children have when they have language difficulties? And we can start, you know, giving teachers and parents and other school psych principals, you know, whoever, coaches, you know, because kids are out in the community too. We can start giving them an understanding of some possible explanations. Like, we don't know if a kid is shy or if they have a language difficulty, but we can start making some of those connections for people so that when they see some of these things, they're also thinking, well, it could be language. So, you know, maybe I need to refer, or maybe we need to get the SLP in here, you know, to look at this, or, you know, maybe they don't need, you know, services from the SLP, but maybe there's some different things I can do in my classroom environment that would really support children who are struggling with language so that they can better succeed, and that I won't just jump to this, oh, he's ornery or he's lazy, you know, like, let's really think about this more, all of the different things that it could be.
Yes, yes. I'm sitting here thinking, you know, back in my school therapy days, talking with the teachers was always a challenge, let's just say, about language, because they really had no clue what it was. And they thought of language as being grammar, you know, and so that they would teach English grammar. And I remember years ago, now I'm thinking that teachers are more advanced in thinking of vocabulary and, you know, if the child knows vocabulary and, you know, looking at the child's ability as they're going through a story, if they know the vocabulary, the meaning of those words or not, and can connect the meanings. So I think teachers are more focused on that. So, you know, there's hope, but, you know, and that really is, and maybe that would be a really good place to start, because I think teachers have become more focused on vocabulary. You know, they've got the grammar thing down of sorts, at least the print language down for grammar piece. Not so sure about the oral piece, but, you know, maybe that would be a place to start, because it really is a challenge to talk with teachers about it. And I have done, you know, just my little, you know, PowerPoints, you know, on staff development days with teachers and stuff, just my little thing that I came up with through the years. But then teachers tend to go back, just as we all do, and do the same thing that they have always done. You know what I'm saying? So this change of, really, it's more of a change of paradigm that leads to many changes of mindsets is huge. But I think it's something that we need to pursue, because if we don't start, we'll never make it. And but it is big.
I do think probably teachers have come a long way, but I think they probably have further to go. My impression is that what teachers tend to know maybe more about is reading. And so they know a little bit about how verbal language might support reading. So you mentioned vocabulary. I think in some teacher training programs, they're, you know, making the explicit link between knowing vocabulary and how that helps with learning to read. So I think we are getting some some understanding of that. But at the same time, like, you know, they're not trained in language the way that we're trained in language. So, you know, still the way they kind of think about it or what they might think of as red flags for language difficulties, you know, are probably different than what we would think of. That we probably have a longer list of red flags, let's say, than what a teacher might have. And so I think you're right that we really need to start building that collaboration with teachers and start building some of that training into our collaborations. You know, I one of my last projects with a doctoral student was looking a little bit at how SLPs get kids with DLD on their caseload. How do they find them? And so most SLPs use a teacher referral. And I think that can be a very good source because, you know, teachers are with kids for a long period of time. They have lots of time to observe them, more so than what an SLP is going to have in their assessment. So, and they're observing them in a an authentic environment. And of course, in the schools, part of qualifying a child for services is that their disability is impacting their education. So, you know, we kind of need that insight of, is this really having an impact? At the same time, we know, and SLPs know too, because this came out in the data, you know, SLPs were worried about how accurate those referrals were from teachers. And the research literature bears that out too, that teachers tend to under refer. So back to that idea of we have a lot more red flags in our bag, they only have a couple. And so it makes sense then that they wouldn't refer every kid that maybe we would want them to refer.
And that's okay.
You know, well, we couldn't handle it anyway, but you know,
we couldn't handle it. But they need to know how to handle it themselves. And I'm not complaining about teachers. I mean, some of my best friends are teachers, you know, but this is an issue. It absolutely is. And you know, the whole piece, the literacy piece. I mean, you know, we're sort of sliding in that direction too. But I mean, you know, you're talking about possibly curriculums, you know, education curriculums at the university level, or maybe encouraging classroom teachers' education to include a language course in the speech language pathology department, those kinds of things. I mean, and wouldn't that be wonderful? You know, is there, who handles that? I mean, is that an ASHA thing? You know, could ASHA do something along those lines, or where does that come from?
I think ASHA could advocate in that direction. I don't know how much success you'd have. I mean, it's just like if someone came to us and said, I think you need to add this into your curriculum. I think we all feel like our master's curriculum is pretty packed.
Full enough.
And I would just guess that teacher training programs probably have that same feel. So I do think it would be great to, you know, try to do more of that, or maybe not add a class, but see if there's a way to integrate something into an existing class. But I also think even if you do that part, I still think you're probably going to need to try to establish that collaboration. And that's really what we're talking about. I'm not trying to bag on teachers either. I think it's really about having that partnership of how do we work together to serve the children. And, you know, not everyone can have those pull-out services. So you're absolutely right that it's not even just the identification part, but it's also that classroom support piece as well, and trying to, you know, give the teacher that kind of support so that they can meet the child's needs well within the curriculum. So, you know, trying to maybe, you know, shift our thinking a little bit too, which ASHA is doing. I don't know if you've seen the ASHA campaign about practicing at the top of the license. It's around those kinds of issues of saying, you know, you don't need to have direct contact with every single child who has a disability, you know, in your school. Thank goodness. There's times where you need to be more of a coach to the teacher or to someone else and kind of teach them to fish, sort of thing. Teach them how to support these children for whomever that might be appropriate for, and then only really be pulling out the kids who, you know, need more than that. So really trying to think about how do we divide up our time time to be just really efficient in what we're doing and really try to establish those collaborations, try to push some of that a little bit off of our direct caseload onto other personnel who can maybe do that. Now, that's a pretty idealized version. There's lots of challenges to accomplishing that as well. But that would be another kind of direction to go, or in addition to trying to get the teachers to be a little more ready for that partnership and coaching.
Yeah. Well, and I'm sitting here thinking, so what could we do? I mean, because the whole premise of this is just excellent. But, you know, getting to reality and day-to-day implementation of this is a challenge. And I'm sure that everybody that you know, was on that committee, you know, part of that group in UK that pulled it together, I'm sure that they are very aware of this. I'm thinking maybe, you know, if you're a speech-language pathologist in the schools, that maybe on a staff development day that, you know, either you partner with a classroom teacher that you know that is really oriented to language, and there's always at least one or two in the school, you know, unless you're new, you know, you kind of have to wait a year or two to sort of let that teacher bubble to the surface. But maybe collaborate with that teacher or the school psychologist, where you all team up and do a day-long presentation, you know what I'm saying? And where you have situations where there's characteristics of kids and you know, just, you know, because you don't want to just identify any kids, but you could make up some examples of some of the components that are, you know, language disordered kids, and talk about it and what could they do in the classroom. Maybe something like, I mean, that would take a lot, but I'm thinking it would be really worth it. You know, if the teachers would follow through, then.
Yeah. And so I'll shift this just a tiny bit. So this is one of the good things about, you know, trying to get this consistent terminology of developmental language disorder, because mm-hmm. it also opens up opportunities for people to find information on their own, so that it's not only the SLP doing the work.
Yes.
So for
yes.
example, USA Rattled, which there's a comment in the chat. What is this? So Rattled stands for Raising Awareness of Developmental Language Disorder. And so that's an international group. And then there's different chapters. So there's now a U.S. chapter of Rattled, and they have a website. And one of the things that International Rattled does is does DLD Awareness Days. And we have one coming up in October 14th, I believe is the date. But they also put together a lot of materials. So for example, last year for DLD Day, they had a bunch of materials aimed at teachers. They had a bunch of stuff about, you know, what does it look like when you have a language disorder? So it kind of the things that I was just saying about, are they shy or is it DLD? That kind of information to help teachers know what the profile is. They also had a number of little things about things you could do in the classroom as a teacher. So like slowing down your speaking, using visuals, repeating information, chunking information. So they had a lot of good tips that they pushed out through the internet, through Twitter. There's also a really wonderful group here in the U.S., DLD and Me. That's a website, dldandme.org. And they have all sorts of informational materials available. And some of them are aimed, well, all of them really are aimed at the public, but they also have some that are aimed more at families and more at children who have DLD. So by using this consistent term and then, you know, having these other groups come together around raising awareness, they're creating a lot of materials that then it doesn't fall just to the SLP to do this. Like, I agree with, like, sure, let's have a workshop, but you might be able to draw some of these materials and pull some of these resources and things. And USA Rattled, I think, even did a little presentation that was aimed at teachers about what DLD is, and pre-recorded and everything. So, you know, you could just play that yeah. during the workshop.
I was thinking somebody needs to do that.
Yeah. So that was kind yeah. of part of your point of like, well, gosh, there's a lot that needs to be done. But by, you know, kind of coming together in this partnership, bringing clinicians and researchers together around what this group is and what kind of the needs are, we can start building some of these common resources that then it's not on the individual SLP who doesn't have this built into their day at all to do these educational things, to be able to pull some of those common resources and not have to make them themselves. I see there was another
couple questions here on the question and answer. Do you see those? Mm-hmm. Developmental language disorder has not been covered by insurance. Expressive language or receptive language, et cetera, have been covered codes. This will be a huge hurdle to get services covered. Are you familiar with that medical?
Yes. And then I see it. The next question is into IEPs. I don't know if it's exactly on the same topic of terminology, but I did want to talk about that. So yes, we have existing terminology in these systems. And, you know, ICD-10 codes are like, they're not going to change that. They're not going to change that for us.
Those are in stone.
Yeah, right. And they're not going to change the IEP eligibility categories either.
No, they're not going to change those.
But what we're recommending is that you use the term DLD in conjunction with those categories. And here's kind of why. First of all, where the heck did those categories come from? Was it because someone sat down and really thought, oh, these are like super helpful diagnostic categories. Like these are, you know, really useful in clinical practice. I don't actually know, but I don't think so. I think these were, you know, people came up with this because, you know, it was a convenient way to categorize stuff. And not that it has no merit, but just, you know, like we don't want to have 100 codes. So if you look at the IEP eligibility categories, I think there's something like 13, right? They wanted a small number and they wanted it mainly for like central data reporting. You know, they wanted all the schools to have a way to report their data back to the government so that you could put it all together. And so we couldn't let schools just make up their own codes. We had to give them some number of codes. And again, we didn't want it to be like a million. And I imagine probably the same kind of thing for the ICD-10 because it's mainly for insurance purposes and so on. So again, you don't want like thousands of these things that then everyone has to agree on these really fine distinctions of what this is. But the problem with these codes is that they're way too general. So in the handout that was part of the resources for this talk, I show just the one category, the IEP category of speech or language impairment. I mean, there's a bunch of stuff that falls under speech or language impairment. So the problem with that is then if you tell a parent, you know, your child has a speech or language impairment, now they go to Google something and all kinds of stuff comes up that really has nothing to do with what their child's difficulty actually is. Whereas if you tell them your child has developmental language disorder, they can now Google that and they'll find something like DLD and me or Rattled. And they'll have some, you know, really good information that's probably very on target and very similar to the kinds of difficulties that their child has. So it's very useful for them to have that ability to find more information. So what we're suggesting is that, for example, in the school context, you might tell a parent, your child's profile matches that of someone who has developmental language disorder, and then you would explain what that is. And that, you know, is impacting their academics, and here's kind of what we're seeing, what the issues are. And so that then qualifies them for services in the school under the speech or language impairment category. So you're kind of being clear with them of this is your child's condition, and then this is their eligibility category, which is, you know, how it works in the school. You have to have a disorder or a condition, and then it has to impact your academics. And then that's what gives you that eligibility. That also really helps you out in the case where someone isn't eligible for services, because you're able to say your child does have this pattern that's consistent with developmental language disorder. So, you know, I appreciate the language difficulties that you're reporting to me. I see that too. And this is what that's called. You know, however, they're working really well in the classroom, or their teacher is really supporting them well. And so their needs are being met and they're succeeding in the academic environment. And so they're not going to be able to get services. They're not eligible because it's not having that academic impact. But now you validate that initial complaint and said, yes, I see that too. And same thing could happen in a medical setting as well. Yes, I see your difficulty, but your insurance company is not going to pay for that, or they are. So it'd be the same kind of thing where you could tell a parent it's developmental language disorder, and then what you're coding is receptive expressive language impairment or whatever code is appropriate. And in some contexts, maybe you don't even need to share that background coding. But the point in sharing that more specific diagnosis is that it gives them clearer information about what you're seeing as the weaknesses and the strengths. Hopefully you're reporting that as well. And that's helping the parent, better understand the child's strengths and weaknesses and have an explanation for what they're observing.
Okay, that makes sense. I'm just going to open this up and we don't have to spend much time on it. But assessments, from your point of view, you know, do we have adequate assessments for that coordinates with the DLD label? Do we have adequate assessments to separate the, well, your kid has DLD, but he's not, but he is succeeding in the classroom? Do you know what I'm saying? Are we refined enough? Do we need to focus on anything else?
Oh, sure we do. Are we doing a perfect job? Are you asking me, are we doing a perfect job, Char?
In assessments, no. Well, I'm not even looking for perfect. I just know when I was in the schools, I was frustrated with the assessments. You know, I mean, it's not like I'm going to put one together that's any better. But I'm wondering, you know, could the assessments, now that we're really narrowing things down here, is there some way that we could even maybe improve and coordinate? You know what I'm saying?
I would say, you know, we do have decent assessments with, you know, good psychometric properties. So we're not, you know, we're not completely flying blind, right?
No.
And there's this consensus, there's some agreement on some of the criteria for developmental language disorder. So again, we're not flying completely blind there. You know, the educational impact piece, I think, has always been kind of a slippery slope and open to interpretation. And a lot of that comes down to clinician judgment too. And so in some sense, I think that's probably okay, that it's probably hard to have like really hard and fast rules for certain things, that we do need a little bit of subjectivity in our decision making. So that's probably okay. But I think there's definitely room for improvement. I'm thinking of this dissertation project that I mentioned earlier by Molly Sultani. Now that I've said it twice, I'll give her credit. Molly Sultani, who is a PhD student at the University of Kansas, and she just finished this last summer. But as I had mentioned, she was looking at how do school SLPs identify kids with DLD, and she did a survey, and then she also did some interviews. And so their interviews, I would say, were really revealing. You know, one of the things they didn't like about standardized screeners is that, and this I think applies to all standardized tests, is that when we do standardized tests, we're really narrowing what we're looking at in language, you know, because we're trying to isolate vocabulary or grammar or listening comprehension or something like this. So we make these kind of contrived tasks that aren't really what kids do. It's not, you know, true use of language or, you know, use of language to communicate. And so they didn't like that. And I think that's probably right to not like that, in a way that if you're only using standardized measures, you're kind of missing what language is for, which is communication. So they wanted some, you know, short tasks that would be more naturalistic, that could still be used to identify a language disorder. So they, you know, they really found that gap. And I think that's a really smart gap to highlight.
There's a real need for that. One or two or three?
Well, you know, Molly and I were spitballing and we were like, you know, narrative's kind of good, but you know, and this is where I was going, you know, we do have some naturalistic things like narrative and language sampling, conversation sampling, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the problem is that analysis piece is so time consuming that it's, you know, it's great to have that real naturalistic sample, but then you have to kind of process it to make sense of it. So
yeah,
I think trying to find, you know, some quicker ways to do that, automatic ways to do that would be great.
Well, and it's, you know, the thing is, we're really trying to diagnose something that is, I don't even know how to explain it. It's just, it's kind of ethereal. And we end up on the tangible things like vocabulary and grammar and syntax and mean length of utterance, you know, things that you can count and that you can measure and so on. But there's got to be some way to really, you know, look at the number of times that the child said, like here, I'm doing it, said, you know, or came up with the wrong vocabulary word, or, you know, had an issue of trying to land what the child was trying to say. I called it the, you know, the child that was in the airport and he would talk and talk and talk, kind of like what I'm doing now. And he would have a hard time wrapping up what he was trying to say. Or he would go all around his intent and would never really focus on it and be able to specify what he's trying to say. I mean, those kinds of things, those are more abstract. But it is language, and it is communication, and it is those things that can really impact the child's expression, I mean, hugely. But how do you, you know, how do you measure that?
Yeah.
How do you determine it? It really is difficult.
It is. I mean, and that's where we have to start getting to some of those language sample analysis measures that are, I mean, you can do it, but you just need like all the time in the world. I'm just kidding. It's not that bad. But, you know, so working towards some more automatic types of coding or categorizing, and there are folks who are working on that type of thing. I don't know how close we are, but I think, I mean, my impression is the way people do that now is that they're just getting that impressionistically. And so it would be nice to quantify it, because obviously if you're maybe going to write a goal towards it, you want to be able to see the movement. So that's where having the greater precision would be really useful. But I think now what most SLPs are doing is that, you know, they might be having those conversations, taking those language samples, and they're just writing down those types of impressions, just as you know, described. And then they might, you know, jump in and, you know, maybe if they want to count to ums, they'll just do a real quick, you know, 1 minute portion of that sample or something and, you know, do some tallies or whatever. So kind of a down and dirty way of doing it, which isn't a bad thing. But it, you know, would be great if we had things that were more automatic in that way, that you didn't have to go through all of that effort and you could have that information kind of more at your fingertips. And maybe even a greater variety of ways to quantify naturalistic language than what we have been doing. So trying to expand some of those measures.
Yeah. You know, I remember back when I was in school, I would send home a case history, you know, prior to the evaluation. I think was it the REEL? R-E-E-L or something like that. I don't know. It's, you know,
that's
it's
a something.
Ancient, I'm sure.
I can't remember. Is that a test or is it a question? I don't know. I can't remember.
Was that a questionnaire or was it a test? I don't know. But I'd send home something. And the parents, you know, would I think it was more of a true, false, or, you know, maybe it was a 1 to 5 and they would grade it or something. I don't know. But it was more in the lines of the child's communication at home. And it didn't focus on grammar and syntax and mean length of utterance. It focused on the child's ability to communicate his or her thoughts. And the parents were actually pretty good at that. And, you know, I could even see maybe teachers doing that, and then maybe the parent, the teachers, and the therapist doing those kinds of things, and then just sort of getting together. And if we had something that was a little more objective, you know, just so that you get kind of a spectrum of observations and in different settings for the child. But at any rate, I'm off.
No, but I did want to comment. I think that is a good idea. And there are several, I can think of a couple other. There's the CCC, I forget what that stands for, something checklist, clinical competence, I don't know, something along those lines. I never know what the words are. And there's some other things like that. There's also one for teachers. It's the TROL, and I can't remember what that stands for. Teacher rating of language, maybe. I think there are two, language and literacy. So there are some of those measures out there. And I think those are really helpful. I think it is helpful to get that you know, just that big picture, like as we were talking about, just with like the screening measures, we don't, there's a role for being kind of reductionist and trying to kind of say, okay, vocabulary looks okay, grammar maybe not so good, you know, kind of trying to pull out strengths and weaknesses. But ultimately, we do want to know what the whole package looks like, as the SLPs were saying for a screener. Like, I want to see this kid in context. I want to see if he can get an idea across. Like, that's fundamentally what we're interested in. So getting those impressions from teachers, parents, and for older kids, the kids themselves, I think that has a lot of value to say, you know, does this overall package, you know, look competent in their communication, especially since we know that, you know, kids with DLD or adults with DLD, they're judged for their communication abilities. So, you know, if you are someone who talks in a circle, you know, you're not going to get certain opportunities. People aren't going to, you know, invite you to be on a podcast, let's say, or, you know, they're going to choose someone that they think is more verbally gifted. And so that pulls away opportunities. It might pull away, you know, promotions and things, you know, that kind of bias comes into play in the way that we think communication relates to intelligence. You know, that's another kind of thing that people might not think you're, you know, very sharp or very knowledgeable in whatever your job or career is. So, you know, that holistic impression really does have a place in what we're doing, so that we can really think about, you know, pull back and take that big picture and say, you know, can this person get a point across? Do they sound like they know what they're talking about, type of thing? Because that's what others are reacting to.
Yeah. A few presidents come to mind. There's been several.
Yeah, really?
Yeah, really, really. Oh, my goodness sakes. Okay. So this DLD can be very helpful and very supportive. For everyone, for the child, I would think. I mean, what are the benefits for the child? I mean, we kind of talked about the parents, definitely, the teachers, but I'm sure that there's some benefits for the child.
Yeah, it's good for kids to know this as well, because, you know, children know if they're struggling. I mean, this is not a surprise, right? Children who struggle with language start to understand what that challenge is. And if we don't give them an explanation for what it is, they're just going to make it up themselves. You know, I had a kid that I worked with who, I mean, he called himself dumb. And he talked about going to his dummy classes, which was seeing me. But he didn't really understand what was going on. That was his explanation. And that wasn't right. I mean, that's not what DLD is. He had many strengths and language was a weakness. But again, nobody talked to him about, well, what's language? You know, what does that even mean? So sharing that type of label with the child starts helping them to understand their diagnosis as well, help them to understand what their strengths and weaknesses are. And it gives you a way to point out their strengths as well, so that they don't just kind of take this overall feeling that, you know, they're just not good enough or something just very global in that way. So it can really help them to understand what those difficulties are. And it can also help look for information, just as it can for parents and teachers and so on. And it can also give them a way to explain their difficulties to others. So there's been a little bit of work on, you know, self-disclosure of what your difficulties are and what kind of an impact that might have on the listener. And, you know, that research is a little bit equivocal, but there are at least some studies that show some promise for that in essence, as we were just talking about, you know, if you're talking and someone doesn't know what's going on with you, they make their own assumptions. They think that you are not a good speaker, or that you don't know what you're talking about and these other types of things, or maybe you're not trying or any of that. But if you disclose that you have this disability, it gives them an explanation for maybe what would be going on, and then they might view you with more empathy and more understanding and wouldn't, you know, kind of jump to some of those conclusions. So there can be some benefits to self-disclosing to others. You know, I have this struggle. I need to do this type of thing. So it also helps you then ask for accommodations as well, if that's something you need to do. And of course, as kids, you know, we know as kids move into high school and they move into college, you know, we don't have many SLP services in high school. So, you know, a child who's able to kind of be their own advocate and do some of that negotiation with the teacher, you know, that's really empowering them to advocate for themselves and ask for accommodations. And then when they go to college, I tell you, we don't give them much, quite frankly. You know, they don't get services, obviously, but there are accommodations when you're in college, but it's more for, you know, testing and note taking and whatnot. And, you know, I think students potentially could do better if they were able to explain to their instructor, you know, I have DLD, these are the sorts of things I need to do, and see if they could get some additional support, if they would get some of that understanding and empathy. So those are some of the benefits to the student themselves of really being able to understand what's happening and to learn more about it, and then giving them that power to advocate for themselves.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, and the word that you didn't say, but I was thinking in my mind, was compensations. Of how they can compensate. And certainly, you know, language impairment, the language disorder, doesn't go away, but you do improve in certain ways and you can compensate. And so it's not like a death sentence, you know, life goes on. And, you know, just like everybody, you know, everybody has some issue that they're dealing with, and that one just happens to be, you know, yours. You know, if we're talking to a child about this. So I like that, in that, you know, you're sort of confronting and saying, here's what's going on. Here's what we can do. We can work together to compensate, and have to work really hard at learning these words, or putting syntax, you know, making sure that everything is put together correctly, and how to shape your thoughts and so on. So that makes sense to me, that you're sort of hitting it, you know, head on. And certainly in with speech impairments, we say, okay, honey, you're having trouble with your R. Okay, we've just bottom line that. And here are the things that we can do. Or, you know, here we're going to be working on your blends or whatever. It's very identifiable and you narrow it down. But in language, I guess we can just, you know, do the best that we can. And identifying it with a really strong label that a lot of people are familiar with is a good first step.
Thinking on that too, I can think of another PhD student's project, Bogie Perlmutter. They did a project where they looked at college students with DLD and their basically like study strategies. And one of the findings from that is that college students with DLD had like a bajillion study strategy, like way more than what normal language, because they were learning this compensation. Now, some of their strategies were ones they came up with, and they maybe weren't the best. So for example, sometimes they would ask an informant who wasn't the best informant. So they'd ask their mom about, you know, a history paper, and you know, their mom wasn't in the history class, so their mom doesn't know this, but as opposed to asking a peer or something like that. So they had some that were maybe a little bit maladaptive, but, you know, they had a lot of compensatory strategies. So again, it opens up that door, and it really opens up that door too to educating them a little bit more about maybe what would be more adaptive. So again, when we think about like, how can we empower our students? What is the thing we could give them that they can kind of build off of? You know, that would be an example of helping them sort of understand what's a good strategy. Like, you're going to need strategies, but what makes a good strategy? And, you know, helping them learn to figure that out. So when we, you know, think about goals, maybe for older students who are going to need to transition more into independence because they're not going to get SLP services forever, that's the type of thing we could think about of, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about study strategies, what makes something a good strategy. And then that way you'll be able to kind of keep coming up with ones, but you'll have a better idea of what makes it good, what makes it bad, or what to kind of think about when making a strategy. So you give them that kind of lifelong lesson that maybe they can, you know, build from once those services are pulled away.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. I really like that. Would you please write those books?
I don't know if I have time for that.
That's always the issue, isn't it?
Yeah, right.
That's the issue. But somebody needs to do that. So, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Get together with some of your friends and work on it. I mean, really. That would be the thing to do, really. Well, thank you so much. This has been really interesting and very helpful. And I think this is a great goal. I'm all for this. And I look forward to seeing the progression as to how it goes. And because you have a lot of different areas to address, that you know, you just get in there and whack away at it so that you have a really, you know, a nice foundation to build on. So very good. Thank you. Thank you. You know, I do have this one last question that I would like to ask you and maybe you can talk with us for 2 or 3 minutes about it. But I call it a life lesson question. And here it is. What are your thoughts about the field of speech-language pathology today?
Well, that's a deep question. Mm-hmm. You know, interestingly, I've been in a lot of meetings lately that have been talking a lot about collaboration, and a lot of them in different kinds of collaborations. But I think we've hit on that a little bit in today's talk. So that's what's mm-hmm. making me think about it. We were talking about mm-hmm. collaborations between, you know, the IEP team, essentially, but, you know, parents, teachers, the SLP coming together to really understand a child's needs and figure out what we're going to do. In some of these other contexts, we've been talking about collaborations between researchers and clinicians. And I think we don't do that enough. You know, we don't have enough crosstalk between the two areas. So we don't have researchers coming out to SLPs and trying to find out, like, what is your biggest problem? What do you need solved? You know, what could I research that's really going to help you out?
I'd faint dead away.
But we need that, right? Because, you
know,
we have to do research that is going to really, you know, impact the field. And so we need to know kind of what are the problems that are out there. Likewise, back and forth, you know, what do researchers need to be able to do the research? And I think this idea, too, of advocacy is another good one of rallying around to say, you know, we need to use this term. We need to get on the same page. We need to make resources that help people learn about this term. You know, if you had Googled specific language impairment, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, I don't know what you would have come up with. I don't think it would have been much. It probably would have been publications, which is not what a family member needs. If you go out and Google developmental language disorder or DLD, you're going to get a lot of good stuff. And a lot of it is really aimed at the public. And so, you know, that's a good public service kind of thing, a good way that we can collaborate together to kind of have this, you know, unified effort to advocate for the people we serve. And, you know, hopefully we'll be able to keep moving this along so that we can, you know, do some more of that advocacy of saying, you know, these children really need services. You know, you think about how children with autism have gotten a lot of services, children with dyslexia are now, there's a little bit more of a movement to get services for dyslexia, a number of bills in state legislatures about say dyslexia and actually diagnose dyslexia, screen for dyslexia, find those kids, get them services. You know, if we want the kids that we serve to get that same kind of advocacy effort, we have to give these labels, we have to give this knowledge, and we have to hope that our parents will start forming these same kinds of support groups and advocacy groups, and we'll start saying, you know, my kid has a thing, they need services, and the person they need it from is an SLP. So we, you know, we need some more SLPs in the schools, or we need some better ways of serving these children, we need more research, whatever it is that are the identified needs, we need to all come together as a community. So I think we need to find more ways that we kind of think together and say, what would really make a difference for a child or an adult with a communication disorder? Now, how can we work together to kind of really move that forward and you know, get more momentum? You know, more people should care about these folks with communication disorders, and you know, we should be seeing more effort to support them. And you know, in this country, I don't think we do a very good job of supporting some folks who are vulnerable. So we really do need that kind of, you know, public outcry, and it's not going to be just from those of us in the field. You know, it needs to be a broader. Even those are a lot of SLPs. There's still very few compared to the, you know, full scope of who's in the nation and who has the power to make decisions and things like that. So, you know, we really need to kind of come together and think about those types of issues and how we can all kind of pull in the same direction and make some change.
Yes, very good. Very good. I like it. Yes, let's do it.
All right.
Let's go. Let's go. Thank you, Holly. Thank you. Thank you. Oh,
I appreciate
you so much. I'm so glad that you're out there and you're on our side. I love hearing you explain the really difficult things, you know, but you know, you're very practical. I like that research orientation that you have, but I love the practicality piece as well. And I just really appreciate that about you. So,
well, thanks so much. Yeah, wonderful to be here, Char. Appreciate the invitation.
Yes,
and
great,
I appreciate your listeners tonight sticking in here. So.
Yes. Yes, yes. And I want to talk to them here for a minute. So in closing, I do want to thank everyone for being here and for tuning in and also for continuing to get the word out about the SpeechLink podcast, where, of course, you not only learn tons of practical information like tonight, you earn CEUs. And do know that in a very few days, you'll be able to access this course through SpeechTherapyPD.com, and you can watch it again if you want. But also, if you desire, you can access the audio-only version on all the popular podcast apps like Apple Podcast and TuneIn and Podbean and all of those. So, and I really want to thank you. I appreciate your supportive comments on those and all your good reviews. Also, if you are planning ahead for next month, for the SpeechLink, you are in luck. You've got another great speaker on Thursday, October 13 at 7 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. The extremely practical and knowledgeable speech-language pathologist Karen Searcy will make her second appearance, and she'll share her insights on ambiguous loss, how to support families during stressful times. Very appropriate. I hope you can attend, and I hope you know just how much you are appreciated. Thank you so much for all that you do for your therapy kids, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.